What do the tribes of Papua New Guinea have to teach us moderns?
New Guinea is vivid, fascinating, but they also do things from which we can learn, such as traditionally never dying of diabetes, heart disease, stroke, raising their children to be independent, self-confident, taking good care of their old people so that old people are not miserable and lonely as they often are in the United States.
That's scientist and author Jared Diamond. We'll talk to him about his latest book, The World Until Yesterday. And yesterday's healers were herbalists. Do plant medicines really work?
Most of the plants that you get have been studied and proven in these research places, or they've been used for so long, for hundreds of years in many cases, that they've proven definitely safe and usually effective.
That's herbalist Holly Bellabono. We'll talk with her about her complete guide to plant-inspired medicine in the second half of the show. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Thanks for joining us. This modern world isn't all it's cracked up to be. Yes, we have the internet, antibiotics, and airplanes, but there's a lot we've lost. Healthy, uncontaminated food, clean air, and perhaps most important, the myriad intimate bonds that used to nurture our human connections back when we lived in small communities. In his latest book, The World Until Yesterday, my guest, Jared Diamond, says that in some ways we moderns are misfits. Our bodies and our practices now face conditions very different from those under which they evolved and to which they became adapted. Diamond's no Luddite, but he does say that we have much to learn from traditional, pre-industrial societies about living well, living healthily, and living within our means. Jared Diamond is the author of several very influential books, including the bestseller Guns, Germs, and Steel, and Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed. He's a kind of polymath. Originally trained in physiology, Diamond's work is known for drawing from a variety of fields, such as ecology and ornithology. He currently teaches geography at the University of California. He brings his wide perspective to bear on some of the most important questions of our time, no less in this latest book than in his earlier works. I asked Jared Diamond what moved him to take up the subject of what we can learn from traditional societies in The World Until Yesterday.
I was moved to write the book by working in New Guinea for nearly 50 years and my fascination with New Guineans, who are really interesting, vivid people who look me in the face when we have a conversation and they don't interrupt the conversation to text message or to take calls on their cell phone. It's full attention, face-to-face conversation almost all day, and also irritatingly intermittently throughout the night, because when you sleep in a New Guinea village, you can hear people shouting at each other and continuing a conversation when they wake up at 11 p.m. and 2 a.m. and 3 a.m. and 5 a.m. So New Guinea is vivid, fascinating, but they also do things from which we can learn, things that we would envy, such as traditionally never dying of diabetes, heart disease, stroke, raising their children to be independent, self-confident, taking good care of their old people so that old people are not miserable and lonely as they often are in the United States. Those are just some examples.
Yes, and you cover a lot of different areas, and we only have a short time to talk, so we'll probably just cover a few of them. But before we get to them, you know, New Guinea is fascinating in that, you know, since the time that you have been there, as you say, over the last 50 years, there have been incredible changes. You know, they've kind of gone from the older world to the modern world. Can you give us some of your thoughts as you've seen those changes? What do you think that's done? Has it been for better or worse for New Guinea?
By and large, it's been for the better, although there have been big problems. Obvious ways in which it's been for the better is that life expectancy has gone up. Instead of more than half of all children dying by the time of what would be their fifth birthday, nowadays most children survive. The frequency of malaria has gone down. New Guineans are getting education. There's university in New Guinea. technical college, people getting enough food, people getting clothing. They've got steel axes rather than stone axes. They have matches rather than fire drills. So materially, their life is much better off than it used to be, and that's why New Guineans themselves are eager to acquire things such as steel axes, matches, and education from Western society.
And have they, however, managed to keep some of the qualities of the older society that they may feel sustain them better than some of the modern ways, as you pointed out?
Yeah. All the traditional New Guinea groups that I know still contain a lot of their traditional ways. New Guinea languages, of which there are 1,000, one-seventh of all the languages in the world, most New Guinea groups still retain their languages, although their languages are under threat, just as are lots of languages, most languages around the world. Most New Guineans still live in villages where they're living together with their parents and children and relatives and friends, so that New Guineans are not lonely. Those are some of the things that have stayed constant.
So it's not inevitable that we must lose what we value of our human heritage to enjoy some of the benefits of modern life?
It's entirely our choice. Even in the United States, we're a society that has had state government, centralized government, ever since the founding of the United States as a European settlement, and the United States is derived from European societies that have had state government for thousands of years. Despite that, in rural parts of the United States, for example, in Montana, where my wife and kids and I spend vacations each summer, in rural Montana, if you have an argument with a neighbor, you don't call in the police, you don't hire lawyers and go sue the neighbor. You know that that neighboring rancher is going to be your neighbor for the next 50 or 60 years, so you got to settle the dispute in a way that allows you to remain on friendly terms. And so disputes in rural Montana are settled in the traditional ways of negotiation, either face-to-face or through an intermediary, rather than bringing in the government and going to trial and hiring lawyers.
Now, of course, there's a wide variety even among traditional societies, which I think is one of the fascinating points of your book. And you do cover areas such as violence, a risk, elder care, and children. And let's talk about children to begin with. You say that traditional societies reveal the outcomes of thousands of natural experiments on how to rear children. What do you mean by that?
By that, I mean that, one, there's a lot of debate in the United States about the best ways of raising children. Should you spank them? Should you not spank them? Should you micromanage them? Should you leave them lots of freedom? Should you raise them bilingually if the mother and father speak different languages? Should you make sure that, for heaven's sakes, they learn only English? So there are all those debates. Now, we could settle the debates if we could do a controlled experiment. If, for example, we could say that from now on in Massachusetts and Pennsylvania, every child will be spanked, and in California and in Kansas, it'll be illegal ever to spank a child. Well, that's not going to happen, and so we can't carry out an experiment that will let us settle whether spanking is good or bad for children. But, in effect, the experiment has already been run, because around the world there are lots of societies that spank their kids, and there are even more societies that don't spank their kids. That's a natural experiment. We can see what happened, actually, in human societies without manipulating the societies ourselves, which we can't do. And we can learn from those natural experiments.
Even more societies that don't spank their kids.
That's right. Among traditional societies, small-scale societies, hunter-gatherer societies never spank their kids. For example, among African pygmies, if a mother or father hits a child, that's grounds for divorce. But in Sweden today, it's also not grounds for divorce, but it's a crime to hit your kid. So there are societies that don't spank the kids, and those are most hunter-gatherer societies, and lots of small-scale farming societies, but not all of them, small herding societies, societies with cows and sheep and goats. They tend to spank their kids rather severely, because if a kid misbehaves and leaves the pasture gate open, then out go the valuable cows and sheep and goats. So you've got to make sure that the child doesn't do that.
So are you saying that, you know, barring other reasons, a natural way of raising children that human beings have evolved is not to spank their kids, and it's more than just not spanking their kids. Talk a little bit more about how hunter-gatherers raise their children.
You're right that it's lots of other stuff besides not spanking your kids in hunter-gatherer societies. Another difference, which I had never thought of, and my guess is that most Americans haven't thought of it, is how you carry infants. Infants in the United States are commonly pushed in baby carriages, where the infant is lying on its back horizontally and its head is away from the direction of travel. So the infant is, as far as it's concerned, it's a passive object getting pushed. It doesn't even see where it's getting pushed. Also, American infants nowadays, they're often carried in baby packs so that the infant at least is vertically upwards. But most baby packs have the infant facing backwards. In hunter-gatherer societies, virtually all of them that we know about carry their infants vertically upwards, not in a baby carriage, and facing forwards, which means that the infant sees where it's being carried. It has the same field of view as the mother or father or person carrying it, and it gets a sense that it's in control. Its body can respond to what it sees. It's thought, it's speculated that this way of carrying kids vertically upright is responsible for faster neuromotor development in hunter-gatherer kids. So there's an example that I never would have thought of that we can learn from traditional societies.
That's so interesting because when my son, who's now grown up, was a baby, he did not tolerate those carriers where the child is facing toward the parent. So I had to get him a backpack where he could face out to the world. And he actually did walk much earlier than most children his age. Yeah, so maybe that's why.
Smart baby. He was asking for what was good for him.
He was indeed. He also asked to be held all the time. And that's another thing. Just the amount of skin contact, the amount of time that children are in contact with their parents, as well as, for example, nursing that goes on until the age of 3 or 4, one would think all these practices would foster more dependent children, but in fact, they seem to foster more independent children.
That's true. They provide a infant with a constant sense of security, of safety, of being cared for. And when you're secure, then you feel eventually more comfortable about experimenting on your own because you've grown up feeling that things are safe. Whereas if you're insecure, then you're less likely to go off experiment on your own because you think it's dangerous. The result is certainly my impression and the impression of most anthropologists and sociologists who work with small-scale societies, that kids there are more self-confident, they're creative, they're more socially skilled, they're more precocious socially than American kids. For example, New Guinea kids, 5 or 10-year-old New Guinea kids will have a conversation with an adult and they'll be self-confident and they'll have a negotiation with an adult, something that a 10-year-old American kid would hesitate to have.
And I'm just going to ID you now, even though this is being pre-taped. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Jared Diamond about his latest book, The World Until Yesterday. You speak in this book about, democratic societies. You've referred to the state. I remember way back reading a book by Marshall Solins about hunter-gatherer societies, in which he spoke about how democratic they are, how egalitarian they are. And I wonder if there are any thoughts on the connection between, you know, say the development of classes and the state and hierarchy translated into how we changed in dealing with our children that might have made them less independent.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It's a really interesting question because whereas it's clear that when you got 10,000 people, you have to have a leader, a centralized government. You can't talk face-to-face. It's not clear why a society of 10,000 people is going to raise its children differently from a society of 30 people. But the fact is that once you get government, which you've got to have once you have thousands of people, government has its own interests, and the interests of government are separate from the interests of individuals. So every government wants its citizens to be obedient, to be good soldiers, to follow the law, and that means that every government wants its children raised to be obedient, to be good citizens, and to obey the law. It also doesn't want its children to be killed because the state has an investment in its children. And so the state does mix into, insert its own views into the raising of children. In the United States, for example, there are things that if you do them to your children, the government will go after you. For example, the government insists we send our children to school. Well, or that you homeschool them in an acceptable way, whereas a hunter-gatherer would say it's nobody's business except the parents on what a child gets taught.
Mm. And yet also hunter-gatherer societies, I mean, you talk about this term, use this term allo-parenting. You say that these societies, it's a lot more than the parents who are raising the children.
You're right. In the United States, the raising of children is overwhelmingly carried out by the parents, and then there are secondary roles of babysitters and school teachers, but first and foremost, it's the mother and father. In small-scale societies, hunter-gatherers and small farming societies, the raising of children is much more communal. I've got friends, American kids who are the children of American missionaries and business people. So my American friends grew up in New Guinea or Kenya. And then as teenagers, they come back to the United States and they have culture shock. One of the first things that strikes them is that in New Guinea or Kenya, they had all these so-called aunts or uncles. That's to say, any other adult in the village was considered an aunt or uncle, played a share in taking care of all the children in the village. And I remember a New Guinea friend telling me that, where did he have dinner at night? Well, he had dinner at whatever hut he happened to be in at 5 or 5:30 in the afternoon. Didn't necessarily have dinner with his parents. All the other adults in the village were substitute, what's called allo parents. And that means that you've got far more social models, not just your own parents. That's particularly important for kids whose parents themselves are complicated, messed up people. In American society, it makes a big difference if you've got messed up parents whether you have alternative role models. And in traditional societies, children always have alternative role models.
Yeah, that sounds really wonderful, actually. I mean, it's a kind of survival trait. I mean, if you have a small number of people in your village, you would need to not just depend on your parents.
Yeah, and one can also say that even for Americans in a society with 310 million people, a child is going to be more socially skilled and is going to learn more if it's in close contact with 15 adults than if it's in close contact with just two adults.
So true. And speaking of some of those adults, I'm a grandmother now, and let's talk a little bit about elder care. I loved what you said about the role of grandparents in many of these societies.
In traditional societies, grandparents routinely play a big role in taking care of their grandchildren. That's partly because people don't move around. Older people live out their lives in close proximity, often in the same hut as or the hut next to their children and their grandchildren and their brothers and sisters and uncles. That makes it then easy for grandparents to take care of children, much more of grandchildren, much more easy than in the United States, where the average American moves every 5 years, so the odds of growing up near your grandparent are low. Grandparents bringing up grandchildren or sharing the bringing up of grandchildren frees up the parents, the mother and father, to spend more time hunting and gathering and farming. And therefore, survival of grandparents is correlated with higher probability of survival and better health of the grandchildren, because the kids are getting looked after, not just by their parents, but by their grandparents. And that effect still exists in modern society. There was an interesting study about Canadians in the 19th century and about people in Finland in the 19th century. From church records, it was possible to reconstruct that kids whose grandmothers survived past the age of 50, the older, longer a woman survived, the more grandchildren, living grandchildren, she ended up with. And the numbers are that for every decade a woman lives past age 50, she ends up with one or two more grandchildren. That's because even in Finland and Canada in the 19th century, grandparents could help with and put resources in and money and social connections for their grandchildren. Hmm. Still true today.
And grandmothers more so than grandfathers?
Well, we've got the studies of the grandmothers. We don't have the quantitative studies of the grandfathers. My guess is that grandfathers are also going to be significant. For example, in the United States, I would guess that grandfathers also play a role in social status and connections and finding jobs and educational opportunities for their grandchildren, whereas the studies in traditional societies are about grandmothers gather, for example, Tanzanian hunter-gatherer grandmothers gathering roots, edible roots, to feed their grandchildren. We don't have comparable studies for Hadza grandparents, grandfathers.
So then, now let's talk a little bit about elder care, the care of elders. This is also something that varies quite a bit. I mean, in your book, Jared Diamond, you cover a range. There are societies in which elders, people who are weak, are killed, and all the way to the other end where they're taken care of until the end. What is the critical difference here, and what is the most important thing that we can learn from this?
Sure. Critical difference is simply whether it's possible to take care of old people. In a nomadic society that shifts camp every day or every week, when you get to a point where an old person is no longer able to walk, it just becomes physically impossible for the younger people to carry an old person when they've also got their babies and their bows and arrows and their pots to carry. So there, the cruel reality is that there's no alternative except to abandon or actively kill old people. Whereas in sedentary traditional societies, where you're in a permanent hut and permanent village all the time, you don't have the problem of carrying older people. And so in those societies, older people are looked after much better than in modern American society. For modern American society, we move so much that it's physically difficult for children, many or most children, to take care of their older parents because the children may be living 3,000 miles away on the other coast.
But it also has something to do with how we view the old. Talk a little bit about the concept of usefulness. I mean, we already have in terms of grandmothers and grandchildren, but there's more to it as well. And what translates to our society of the usefulness of the elders in traditional societies?
Sure. Usefulness of elders in modern society, in some ways it's down and in other ways it's up. A way in which old people are much less useful in the United States today than in traditional societies is that we've got writing. And so if you want to know something, you don't call up your mother or grandmother or grandfather. You look it up in a book or you Google it. Whereas in a society without writing, you don't have that option. The only way to find something out is by asking an older person who's got the experience and knowledge. That's a respect in which old people have become less valuable in the modern United States. A respect in which they become more valuable is that because of the rapid rate of change, both technological change and social change, the conditions today are different from the conditions 20 years ago. But the conditions 20 years ago might come back. For example, young Americans today don't have personal experience of a Great Depression or a world war or food rationing, but it's perfectly possible that a depression and food rationing and a war will come back. If it does come back, then the young politicians, 20 to 50 years old, who have no experience of war and depression, won't have the experience to cope with these events. dense, whereas it's the older people who've got the experience. So paradoxically, the rapid rate of change not only makes old people less useful. I don't know how to turn on my television set in the house. I have to rely on my kids to do that. But the rapid rate of change also means that the experience of old people is unique. The young people don't have it.
Yes, and I was thinking in your book that, you know, in a time of climate change and resource depletion and peak oil and things of that kind that we're moving into the future, we may be actually drawing back to a more local reliance, more village communities. Maybe in the last minute or two that we have here, say, what do you think are the most important lessons that we should take from your book going forward?
The most important lessons, I would say, are twofold. One, that these traditional societies that I've worked in a lot in New Guinea in the last 50 years, and lots of visitors and anthropologists have lived in them, they're just fascinating. If you would like really interesting stuff to read about, you don't have to read a novel. You can read what actually happens in other societies that are wildly different from ours, but they're still humans that you can understand. So, conclusion number one, this is just fascinating stuff, and that's why I wrote the book. And conclusion number two, they carried out these thousands of different experiments, and some of them we can learn from, such as how to stay healthy and how to raise our kids to be self-confident and how to assess dangers realistically and what religion really involves and why it's better to raise kids speaking a couple of languages than just speaking English. So there's that practical payoff besides the fascination.
Well, Jared Diamond, thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. Your book is The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn from Traditional Societies. I found it an absolutely spellbinding read.
Thank you very much.
You can read an excerpt from Jared Diamond's book, The World Until Yesterday, by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we'll explore the age-old wisdom of herbal healing with Holly Bellabono. Stay tuned after the break.
Slowly and giving shade, there lies a benefaction made, and is a benediction said over the living and the dead. In father bright and leaves released, fly round the wing and we are pleased to walk on radiance amazed.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I've been a dabbler in herbal medicine since the time I lived in rural West Virginia. There, old-timers and new back-to-the-landers alike availed themselves of the rich store of healing plants growing all around, of which ginseng was only the most famous. Herbal healing, though as ancient as humans, is alive and well in the modern world. That's in spite of the dominance of the conventional pharmaceutical industry. Or perhaps because of it. Many see plant medicines as cheaper without the harsh side effects of modern drugs. And those who make their own herbal medicines have the satisfaction of knowing exactly what went into them. My guest, herbalist and author Holly Bellabono, directs Vineyard Herbs, Teas, and Apothecary on Martha's Vineyard. She's the author of several books and numerous articles about plant medicines, and she teaches an online course on the subject. Her latest book is The Authentic Herbal Healer, The Complete Guide to Herbal Formulary and Plant-Inspired Medicine for Every Body System. Well, Holly Bellabono, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
You've written this book, The Authentic Herbal Healer, The Complete Guide to Herbal Formulary and Plant-Inspired Medicine for Every Body System. Explain to us what a formulary is.
Formulary is the act of putting together herbs in order to create a blend from which you can heal illnesses or instances of pain or suffering, whether it's emotional or physical.
I've actually been kind of playing around with plant medicines for many years, but I had never heard the term simple, or actually I had heard the term simple, but I didn't know what it was. So contrast what a simple is to a formulary.
Okay, so a simple is the act of just using one herb. It's simple. It's not complex. It's one herb that can be used for an issue of the body. So if you use echinacea for immune support, you're just using echinacea. But if you have a formula and you're practicing polypharmacy, is really what it's called, you can include many herbs, from two up to however many. So if you have echinacea for immune support, but you also have a sinus infection, then you could include osha along with the echinacea and mint and horseradish, and that would be your formula. The formulary has had an interesting history because there are different cultures and different people to approach it differently. So some people are simplers, and they just use that one herb, and they get to know that plant really, really well and its effects in the bodies and all the various ways you can use it. And then there's the other end of the spectrum, like Chinese pharmacists who might put up to 40 or 50 herbs in a single formula.
And what's your perspective on that? It seems like it's incredibly complicated. If you're putting as much as 40 herbs in something, wouldn't some of the herbs be canceling each other out?
You would think so, and certainly that's a possibility. Whoever is putting them together would have to know what they're doing really well and make sure the herbs are actually complementary and not oppositional. My personal look at it is what I explain in my book is keep it to a minimum. It's good to have blends because the different herbs in your blends can do different things while you're taking them at the same time. And they can also affect how the others are absorbed or used by the body. And so by using just a few, and my formula uses a four-tier system, so four herbs, that allows the herbalist to get creative and address a variety of issues that could be happening, but not to overdo it. And so that you're still very on very intimate terms with those herbs, and you know what's going on.
And what do you mean by a four-tier? What are the tiers?
So the four tiers are, they're flexible. They can be changed. What I put down in my book is kind of a foundation that herbalists can draw from. The first tier, in my mind, is always support and nourishment. And if you're looking at a formula, you want to have the most herb, the most quantity of an herb in there is really nourishing. You don't want it to be a hard hitter attack herb. You want it to be a support for the whole body or the whole system or the organ that you're working with. That's tier one. Tier two is your specific. So that's the herb that's really going to affect a symptom that you're addressing. Tier three is a corollary or another adjunct herb that goes along with the specific. And tier four could be either a carrier, because there are certain herbs that have an affinity for a certain part of your body. There are certain herbs that really go to the urinary system, or there are certain herbs that really go to the head. And so it could be a carrier, a vehicle to take the other herbs in that formula with it and make it more effective. Or tier four could be a bitter. And bitters are a great category of herbs that help stimulate digestion and can make the whole formula more easily assimilated by the body.
Okay, so I have a problem I'm dealing with right now. Could I ask you to apply this principle to my problem?
Yeah, and what I can give you would be a very rudimentary, quick suggestion because you know, we don't have time to go into everything about you and look at you holistically as a whole person and everything that's going on. But I could give you a quick, you know, superficial, this is where I would begin.
Okay, great. So I have a canker sore. And I get them, you know, maybe every few months, something like that. It's also something that affects my family, so it's probably somewhat genetic.
Mm-hmm.
What might be a good formula for canker sores?
So some people, when they come to me, when they say canker sore, they mean cold sore. So is that what you mean?
No, I mean canker sore.
Okay. And where is it located?
On the tip of my tongue.
Okay. So let's see. If we were to use the four-tier formula, we would want something nourishing and supportive. We would want something specific. We would want a corollary, and then a vehicle, most likely. So for a canker sore, something in the mouth, something that is easily infected, something that causes stress and frustration, I would look at it with the tier one as looking for an herb that can ease your stress and frustration around that, something that supports your central nervous system and helps you deal with it. There are a variety of those herbs. Red clover is a great one. Lemon balm is a great one. So let's say lemon balm.
Mm-hmm.
I would go partly with lemon balm because it's a nervine tonic, and it helps reduce stress. It helps your body adapt to stress. It's also antiviral, so it has this secondary ability in this formula to help keep infection at bay. So that would be my tier one. The specific, it depends. There are a number of herbs that would be useful in soothing the canker sore as well as killing any infection. Mergum resin is a really popular one for the mouth. You see a lot of mouthwashes that include myrrh. So that's a possibility. Something more soothing if it's really, you know, irritated and inflamed might be slippery elm. And I'm thinking of this as a mouthwash kind of a formula. Something that you could swish around the tongue and then spit out. So I would do lemon balm, either myrrh or slippery elm. In fact, I would use one of those as tier two and one of those as tier three, myrrh and slippery elm. And then either the carrier or the vehicle, does the canker sore, and I imagine there's a lot of swallowing and there's extra saliva coming out because it's irritated, does it create digestive issues like an upset tummy or nausea or ickiness in the tummy?
No, it's not that bad at this. And I don't think they generally do because I stop eating a whole lot when I have them.
So it causes you to eat less because it's uncomfortable?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you might want something more like just something soothing for the tongue itself?
Yeah.
Yeah. What else are you experiencing with the canker sore? What other, do you notice any side effects?
I haven't, but I did try something yesterday, which is I put baking soda right on that, and it calmed it down a bit.
It's inflamed?
It was really, really sore. So I just put some baking soda on and right on it, and I also chewed some sage leaves because I thought that would be good for antibacterial, and that's calmed it down quite a bit, like cut it by about 50%.
That's great. Well, let's go with the sage. So one possible way to do this, and you could do like you said, the baking soda, like a little paste right on top of it. You could do a mouthwash. You could make a tea blend, you know, that you would drink and swallow, but it would affect it, you know, a little bit longer. So I'm thinking a mouthwash. So I would do the lemon balm, myrrh, slippery elm, and sage. And the sage is a nice one because it's also astringent and cooling.
And what does astringent do?
Astringent is a toning herb that generally tightens tissues. Mm. So anytime you have a weepy, moist area that needs drying and cooling, something astringent like witch hazel or sage is an excellent choice.
Mm.
So that's a possible. Mm-hmm. You know, there are many ways that you could go about it, and that's just one, you know, off the top of my head, that using that formula structure that would give you some support and some direct effect on the canker sore, as well as some toning and cooling.
Well, that sounds like wonderful advice, and I'm definitely going to use it. Now, I understand it, when you say a mouthwash, this is something you could make out of a tea, or would you have to prepare the herbs, for example, in a tincture, have them prepared already for, you know, something you had made over a period of time?
You could do either one. Either one would be very effective. If you have tinctures of these herbs already, you could put them into a little bit of water and use that as your mouthwash, swish it around and spit it out. It's not formulated to be taken as a tincture. It's a mouthwash. Or if you have these fresh or dried herbs, then you can chop them up, simmer them, and make a tea, and that will be your mouthwash. So either way, that's part of the beauty of herbs, is that they're so versatile and so flexible, and you can use them in a variety of ways, even for just one condition.
And we're talking with Holly Bilobono. Her book is The Authentic Herbal Healer, The Complete Guide to Herbal Formulary and Plant-Inspired Medicine for Every Body System. You know, this is not a typical herb book. It feels to me more like something where you are teaching people the underlying principles of how to work with herbs. Is that right?
Yeah, that's kind of how I envisioned it when I began. My first book, published by Shambhala, was a how-to, a craft guide, really, how to make a lot of recipes, how to enjoy fresh herbs and use them in your kitchen, and really enjoy the making process and the creative process. This book, I really wanted to explore herbal medicine deeper and go into more herbs and do it by body system so that it's easy to look up illnesses or conditions based on where they happen in the body, and really explore if you are an herbalist or a healer or a midwife or a naturopathic doctor, someone who wants to learn herbal medicine kind of on the side perhaps or as your main career, where do you begin? You know, I wanted this book to answer a lot of basic questions and show the basic, this is an overview of what herbs do, and this is how you begin to use them in your practice.
And you do teach. You have an online course, is that right?
Mm-hmm. I do. I have an online distance learning curriculum. It's called the Heritage in Healing Herbal Studies Program. And it includes this book as well as my first book and different study guides and materials that help usher people into this extraordinary heritage that we've got. To have fun with it and also to learn the pharmacology and the chemistry behind it.
And how does that work? I mean, do people do homework and then they get in touch with you? And is it an interactive?
It is, yeah. It's like having a personal tutor, basically. Mm-hmm. You're given the time to do it on your own. There are 19 lessons, and it's, you know, to take anywhere between 12 and 18 months. Doing it on your own, doing hands-on projects on your own, really having a chance to experiment with the plants that grow around you, and then coming back to me for evaluation and talking it through, and kind of like having a personal tutor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that's really how I learned. I did courses with other herbalists, but I also did hands-on working with people right there. You know, I would go out in the fields in the woods with old-timers who weren't herbalists per se. They were just old folks who had done this all their lives, and to work with plants was, you know, second nature to them. And they really taught me a lot about what plants are, which trees do what, which herbs do what, how to prepare them. That's a great way to learn, is side by side with somebody. And that's why I offer an apprenticeship program as well. So I live here on Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts, and I open up my gardens to apprentices throughout the summer for either two-week apprenticeships or for the whole season, so that people can come and get their hands-on experience with herbs here.
That sounds wonderful. Now, so I have some questions about, you know, getting herbs. I have found over the years that herbs that I gather myself seem to be far more effective than herbs that I have, say, gotten from my local Whole Foods store.
Mm-hmm. And I agree. Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot more than pharmacology and chemistry in a plant. I think there's a lot of energy that we haven't figured out exactly what it is, whether it's a spiritual force or whether it's chemistry that we haven't discovered yet. Fresh plants have a lot of that vitality to them. And when you harvest them yourself and you use them immediately, they're really, really strong.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the plants that I use, I'm using fresh. I harvest them myself, either that I've grown or that I've gotten in the wild. And they make really potent medicines, which is wonderful. And then dried herbs, they have a different energy about them. They have a shelf life of, you know, like a year and a half to 2 years for teas and such if they're stored properly. But A lot of stores, unfortunately, they have these bulk bins where you can go scoop out a certain amount. And for the most part, they're okay, but they're glass, see-through glass. The light gets to them. The herbs start to lose their potency and fade. There's a lot of spiritual magic, I think, in the fresh plant, especially if you've harvested it, or and especially if you've grown it. You've developed a relationship with that, and that's a big part of herbalism.
And can one grow most herbs in any place, or, you know, that one most could one make an herbal medicine cabinet? Would you say that could cover maybe most kinds of first aid or garden variety issues in one's own home in any climate, or is one restricted?
Well, definitely not every herb will grow in every place, but I definitely think that if you have the opportunity to grow a few herbs and find a few wild herbs, that you're set. You know, they're so versatile, especially the weeds. The weeds that just pop up on their own are so medicinal and helpful, like yarrow and red clover, the witch hazel tree. These are herbs that most people don't plant. You know, they grow on their own. And you can do so many things with them based on their actions. If they're anti-inflammatory or if they're a circulatory stimulant, you can use them for a wide variety of issues. So, yeah, I think that if you have access to even just between 5 and 10 different plants, you can affect a great many solutions to health issues and basically have your own medicine cabinet. And it's very cheap and it's very fun. And you really get to know those plants really well if you're working with a small number like that.
Hmm. And so what might be some plants? Well, you did just mention some that one could gather. If one wanted to have a small herb garden, what might be some of the herbs that could be applied in the most common kind of ailments?
Well, one that you mentioned a few minutes ago, sage. Sage is very useful and very versatile. That would be a key one. Any of the Mediterranean herbs like that, sage, rosemary, thyme, oregano, lemon balm, mint. A lot of the mint herbs are fantastic, very useful. Another one that I would suggest people plant is motherwort.
Hmm.
And motherwort is in the mint family, and it's a cardiovascular support herb. Its Latin name is Leonura cardiaca, which means heart of the lion.
Hmm.
Really great for supporting cardiovascular health and easing hypertension. But it's also a nerving tonic, and it's called motherwort because it's an herb that's really relied upon by mothers who are just frantic and frazzled and exhausted, running around after their young children, or especially for people who are panicky. It has a really wonderful anti-anxiety effect on the central nervous system. So that's a really easy herb to grow and an easy herb to use. It's also very bitter, so it's a good digestive stimulant. Very useful.
And are there any, you know, cautionary tales? Like, for example, I have found comfrey. I always have a comfrey plant. They're so easy to grow.
Yeah.
I brought it everywhere that I have moved to. But I never use it internally because I understand it can cause cancer. And I have to say that I use it externally for it's just been the only thing that I can use that will really cure poison ivy, although I've never actually seen that written down, but it seems to work wonders. And it also heals cuts and things of that kind quite quickly. But I understand you can't take it internally. Could you explain some of the cautions that one has to have?
Sure. Now, some herbalists will take it internally, and they do recommend that, but I'm not one of those herbalists. I don't use it internally, either the root or the leaf. I use it strictly externally, the leaf, because it is a fantastic skin healer. But you do have to use caution. There are some people, if you came to me and you said that you were suffering with cancer and you had these cuts, I would recommend herbs besides comfrey to heal your cuts because different chemicals in comfrey leaf can be absorbed by the skin.
Mm.
And if you apply it once or twice, I wouldn't worry about it, but it's not something you would want to use on a regular basis. And the chemicals in comfrey that are most of a concern to people are the pyrrolizidine alkaloids, called PAs. So when you go to the store and you see a tincture or a capsule of comfrey, it usually says PA-free. They've removed that alkaloid. But if you're growing it on your own and you don't have any cancer risk, using it on the skin is absolutely safe, and it's a very effective herb.
Now, would it still be effective if they remove it? In other words, I guess the question I'm asking is, you know, one of the things people say is that over-the-counter medicines, they have an active ingredient, but they've taken out all these kinds of other supportive compounds that may that are in the natural plant. Could you explain how this works? And then I guess, you know, could it make comfrey less effective if they took away the PAs?
Yeah, that's one of the big debates in the whole industry is an isolated extract really that effective? Are the so-called active compounds in a plant the only thing that we need? When they remove the pyrrolizidine alkaloids, they're doing it for a safety reason, not because it's ineffective and everything else is the active compound. They're removing it because that's the risky chemical, and it can be removed. And as far as the rest of the plant being effective, I guess it depends on what you're using it for. A lot of plants have an alkaloid or a resin or something in it, an essential oil that is often perceived by commercial industry as being, this is the part of the plant that makes it work. Whereas herbalists tend to approach it more holistically and say, the whole plant, you know, there are probably hundreds of compounds in this plant, and we don't quite understand yet how they interplay together, what the balance is. And so it's important to use the whole plant. And generally that's done. Comfrey is one of those exceptions because it has the PAs removed. But generally you'll find herbalists supporting not isolating that so-called active compound. Did that answer your question?
It does. It does. And finally, you know, I imagine there may be people listening to this show who are saying, yeah, but none of this is proven, and how can you tell if, you know, you even if you buy something in the store, even in the bin, you know, how can you tell how much of the active, you know, of the healing compounds remain? You know, in other words, it's not regulated. And maybe those are two questions, but I guess one, you know, what is really the scientific basis upon which you found your work?
I approach it from two angles. One is the science angle, and one is the heritage. And scientifically, there haven't been that many plants studied thoroughly, and part of the reason is because you can't patent a plant, and so the companies who do the research aren't making a lot of money off this research. There are a few, especially in Europe, that have been well studied scientifically, clinically. St. John's wort, ginkgo, echinacea, eleuthero, which is Siberian ginseng. Those are some of the herbs that have been rigorously studied, and we know a lot about their chemistry and why they work and how they work, and we can pinpoint, yes, it's effective for this, no, it's not effective for that. Most other herbs that haven't been put through that rigorous research, we tend to know a little bit about their pharmacology and why they work, but most of the information that we've gleaned is empirical. So it's been passed down from generation to generation. It's been based on observation, whether in the family or in the clinic. And it's been trial and error as well to see over time what are the results of using this particular plant for this particular issue. So it's a little bit of both. It's part folklore and heritage, and it's part science and especially clinical research. Altogether, I think it's very trustworthy, and it's very effective. There's still a lot left to learn, and there are definitely those dubious companies who will substitute or, you know, adulter different herbs to make them not as effective as they should be. But I think that's pretty rare. Most of the plants that you get have been studied and proven, you know, in these research places, or they've been used for so long, for hundreds of years in many cases, that they've proven definitely safe and usually effective.
Well, the book is The Authentic Herbal Healer. We've been talking with the author, Holly Bellabono, and we'll have a link to your website also if people want to find out more about your apprenticeship programs and your online course. They can find it there. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Francesca. I enjoyed it.
Holly Bellabono sells herbs and herbal preparations at Vineyard Herbs, Teas, and Apothecary on Martha's Vineyard. She directs a distance education course, the Heritage and Healing Herbal Studies Program. Find out more at www.vineyardherbs.com or go to Writer's Voice for the link. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.